Are the parties ready to proceed? Please be seated. Ms. Hudgens.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Marla Hudgens, and I represent the appellant Roy Marion in this appeal. This case is about the balance of two public policy considerations: the district court's ability to manage its own docket on the one hand, and a prisoner litigant's access to the courts on another. In this case, the district court abused its discretion by dismissing the plaintiff's case with prejudice on the grounds that he purportedly failed to file an opposition to a motion to dismiss. The decision was arbitrary and capricious because the plaintiff did prepare an opposition to the motion, but because he was subject to the whims of the prison mail system, he was not able to timely file it. As this court has previously recognized in Kellogg versus Journal Communications, the proper person litigant incarcerated stands in a position much different from an average litigant. He has no control over the process by which he receives his mail. He cannot personally deliver his filings to the district court, nor can he monitor the process by which the filings are transmitted to the district court. As a result, a prison litigant is prejudiced both on the front end of a procedural deadline because of the inherent delays in receiving his mail, and he's prejudiced on the back end of the procedural deadline because of the inherent delays in actually filing his papers with the court. And for these reasons, the Kellogg Court determined that a prison litigant's papers are deemed filed on the day that they are submitted to prison officials, even if they are not officially filed by the district court clerk until later. Thus, under Kellogg, Mr. Marion's opposition to the motion to dismiss should be deemed filed on March 26, 2013. Appellant acknowledges that his opposition was technically due on Friday, March 22, 2013. However, appellant's submission of the opposition no more than two business days later, on Tuesday, March 26, should not justify the ultimate case-ending sanction that he received, dismissal with prejudice.
Where should we draw the line, Ms. Hudgens? 2 days, 3 days, a week? We've already seen a line being drawn up before 1 year, or at 1 year. Where should we draw the line?
Well, I would suggest that it depends on the type of practice that the court is looking at. So, for example, when you're looking at a 30-day deadline, as you saw in Kellogg, that was a time period under which the court recognized the extreme prejudice that a prison litigant may be under. So, for example, the timing rules for an average litigant provide 3 days for mailing, but what they don't provide is additional days for a prison to sort through mailing for an entire prison system, for once that's sorted to actually be delivered to the prison litigant. And then once the prison litigant prepares his filings, to then submit to the prison officials, be transferred, in this case, from Indian Springs, Nevada to Las Vegas, and then actually be filed. And so in this case, the respondent suggests that the delay was Mr. Marion's fault alone. However, throughout this case, you can see the prison mail system's delay affect each and every one of his filings. Even though this case was procedurally short, here's some of the timelines that I would like to suggest support this idea that the mail system prejudiced Mr. Marion. For example, on December 27, 2012, the complaint was signed and submitted to prison officials. It was not actually filed until January 18, 2013. On March 26, his opposition to the motion to dismiss was submitted to prison officials. It was not actually filed until April 2nd. And then again, on April 5th, he submitted a notice of appeal, and that was not filed until April 11th. Consequently, throughout the proceedings, we see anywhere between a 6 and a 22-day delay in the process of submission of papers and the filing of the paper with the district court. And so under the circumstances where a litigant has a 10-day period of time, it's important not just to remember the date upon which he's actually filing the papers, but to build into the system an idea that he may be delayed at the very beginning. It could be a 5-day delay. It could be a 10-day delay. We've seen, just in this case, a delay of between 6 and 22 days. And so where we have a case that's less than 2 months old, and we have a 2-business-day delay in the actual filing of an opposition to motion to dismiss, I would suggest that that's not the type of lack of due diligence that this court has previously required as an element to justify dismissal in a case for lack of prosecution.
Ms. Hudgens, what I'd like to do is, I think we understand your argument on the procedural default here. Perhaps if we can get to the merits of the case on the negligent claim. I assume that Mr. Marion's claim is for negligent infliction of emotional distress. Is that the basis of his complaint then?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Let's jump ahead. Let's say we agreed with you. The case was reversed. Opposing parties moved for summary judgment and were before the court, and they raised the issue like you've done here that the elements are not all met, and probably specifically damages. What evidence would Mr. Marion propose to show that he suffered legally sustainable damages? We certainly know he's very upset about this. I mean, we understand that, but what would be the evidence of the damages?
Well, I would like to suggest that other courts have confronted similar circumstances such as these. And so, for example, in a 2003 case that came out of New Jersey, mm-hmm. there was a similar type of damages that were alleged in a negligent infliction of emotional distress case. This is the Doe versus Arts case that I've cited in my briefing. And in this case, the plaintiff claimed almost the exact same damages that we have here. It says, between the time of his diagnosis of HIV and when he received notice of the correct reading, which was that he did not have HIV, he had ended his relationship with his girlfriend, he had lost his business, he was unable to maintain a job, he had not paid his taxes, and he was depressed. And as a result, the Doe court not only upheld the jury's verdict, but found that the jury's judgment of $300,000 was appropriate for pain and suffering in that case.
But under Nevada jurisprudence on negligent infliction of emotional distress, do you have to show a physical injury?
Mm-hmm. Right, I understand that, Your Honor. And if you're asking whether or not he could prove his mm-hmm. case, that's not what I believe the court is here to do today.
Okay.
So there's has not been any discovery that's been conducted. Mr. Marion has not had an opportunity to be evaluated. We don't have records of, for example, if he received psychological evaluations while he was in prison or afterwards. Those are the types of questions that are appropriate, as Your Honor suggested, later on down the road after discovery. Mm-hmm. However, with respect to the motion to dismiss, the requirement is for the plaintiff to simply plead sufficient facts to put the defendant on notice of what its claims are. And so in this case, we know that the defendant had sufficient notice of the claims because in not only the motion to dismiss, but also in the documents filed with this court, the defendant summarizes those claims. For example, in the joint appendix, page 12, they've outlined the claim here that Mr. Marion went to the plasma center twice in 2011, that he was called back to the plasma center. When he was called back, he was misinformed or provided false information that he was HIV positive, and then he found out later that that was not true, and he suffered emotional harm as a result of that. And so the fact that they've summarized this, not only in the motion to dismiss, but also in the papers filed with this court, demonstrates that they are on notice of what the claims are and what the damages are that Mr. Marion purports to have.
Your point is that he should have been given the opportunity to be heard on whether or not he states a legal claim for relief and to have discovery in support of that claim if he does so, but he was thrown out of court on a technicality way too early. I mean, is that essentially what your point
That's
is?
That's absolutely correct. This court has announced time and time again that the public policy of Nevada is to hear a case on its merits whenever possible. And in this case, Mr. Marion did not have the opportunity to present the merits of this case. And so for that reason, I would suggest to the court that the proper remedy would be to remand the case back to the district court to consider the motion to dismiss on the merits.
Thank you, Ms. Hedges. Mr. Coffey.
Justice Sadin, Justice Pickering, Justice Gibbons, may it please the court. Talacris Plasma is a, they own and operate something like 60 donor centers in the United States, a product which is used to manufacture life-saving products, plasma products, as well as life-saving medicines all over the world. In fact, they're one of the leading collectors. Just wanted to provide that little bit of perspective. Now, when Judge Silver, now Justice Silver, dismissed this case, the minute order provided basically two grounds for dismissal. One was the local rule 220E, which relates to filing a late opposition or no opposition. And the other one was basically advancing the case and deciding it before a hearing for on the merits.
Mr. Coplitz, I think as Justice Gibbons said, let's cut to the chase. If we assume based upon existing precedent that there's some exceptions or considerations that should be given to extending time periods for prisoner litigants. And I'm not saying that we have, but let's assume that to be true.
Okay.
Doesn't it appear as if, although I might agree with you that the complaint in this case might need to be amended to allege certain classes of action, shouldn't Mr. Marion have been given that chance to at least proceed with this case, not have it dismissed so summarily, particularly at this early stage? I mean, isn't that what almost every state's jurisprudence suggests?
Well, Your Honor, that's a very good question, and I think I may have an answer for you in that regard. As we argued in to the district court, as well as in our opening brief, amendments should not be allowed to a complaint if it would be futile. And interestingly enough, this court addressed that question in the Halcrow case, which I'm sure Justice Sada recalls as she was the author of the opinion. It was a very complicated case, and the architect, Halcrow, had filed a motion to dismiss various claims based on negligence. That motion was granted by Judge Gonzalez. The contractors then sought to amend their complaints, third-party claims, whatever, to add claims for negligent misrepresentation. And that motion was also granted. However, the court stayed the proceedings and to give time for Halcrow to file a petition for a writ of mandate to prevent, or rather to vacate, the order allowing amendment of that complaint or those complaints. This court did issue a writ of mandate, which prohibited that amendment by vacating the order. The basis was that the economic loss doctrine is applicable to a claim of negligent misrepresentation. which I think is particularly appropriate in this case, and then cited the case of Sebi v. Carpet Barn, Inc., 109 Nevada 78, that a proposed amendment would be futile if the amendment seeks to plead an impermissible claim. And so this court says, nope, you can't plead negligent misrepresentation, so it did not allow the amendment. So I think in this case, I can't imagine what sort of claim that Mr. Marion could bring.
I think what Ms. Hudgens is saying, Mr. Culp, is that it's not negligent misrepresentation, it's negligent infliction of emotional distress, which then you have to look at, can he prove the elements of that tort? So I think it's different than Halcrow. I mean, Halcrow was a construction defect case, and we had, you have to show under the economic loss doctrine, yeah, I mean, you have either personal injury or property damage, and I guess that couldn't be shown in Halcrow because it was an economic issue that was subject to litigation, as I recall. This is a little bit different, though, at least as to the, as I understand the nature of the case of being an injury sustained by him based upon negligent infliction of emotional stress. So what's your thoughts on that?
Well, my first thought is that, and you actually touched on this for a moment, is that in Nevada, and I think probably the majority of states, some kind of physical impact is required to substantiate a claim for negligent infliction of emotional distress, which produces emotional distress. If there is no such contact or impact, physical injury, then the emotional distress itself has to be the cause of physical manifestations of the distress, such as a post-traumatic stress syndrome or chronic indigestion or nightmares that go on. There has to be something there.
And we understand.
No, at this juncture that we don't have that. That's the question that I have. At the pleading stage.
Well, there are other distinctions, particularly with this, the case that Doe v. Arts that's been cited by the plaintiff, and which distinguished the situation very much from the present one. In the Arts case, that dealt with a medical facility and dealt with doctors and staff that are hired by the patient to diagnose and treat diseases. Now, in this case, there's no the Talacris Plasma Resources is not a medical facility. It is a donor facility where services are not provided to the donor. It's a contract, basically. The donor says, I'll give you my plasma, and Talacris says, we'll pay you for that. Actually, the contract doesn't exist until the screening process has taken place.
Which is where everything went bad in this case.
That's right. So,
but having said that, let's assume for a moment facts that are not, I admit, before us. Isn't it yet possible that without the abrupt dismissal of this cause, that Mr. Marion could show physical manifestation of some sort if given an opportunity to do so?
Yes, you're right. Well, I doubt it, but maybe he could. But the point I'm trying to make is it would still be founded in negligence, in which case there has to be some physical or damage to person or property.
I don't know that we'd necessarily disagree with you, but the fact of the matter is this is a 12B, essentially. And so it's gone without almost a wave goodbye, if you will.
Well, basically, they're arguing for an exception to application of the economic loss doctrine, and there have been a number of exceptions carved out, like, for example, for intentional torts. and also for negligent counseling by attorneys, physicians, financial advisors, those sorts of things. Here, I think one of the things that was stated in the Halco case might be relevant is that this economic loss doctrine basically applies to all negligence claims, unless there is an exception that's been carved out. As the court said in Terracon, the door was left open to exceptions in certain categories of cases when strong countervailing considerations weigh in favor of imposing liability. And there was a federal case, Las Vegas Metro Police Department v. Harris Corporation. It's 2014 U.S. District Lexus 94468, where the court there noted that Halco basically indicated that the economic loss doctrine applied to all negligence claims. And the plaintiff had the burden to show an exception because of strong countervailing considerations. I don't think the plaintiff in the case before the court now has made such a showing.
Or been given an opportunity to do so.
Yeah, correct. So I would say the loss doctrine definitely applies here unless something can be conjured up to say, no, in this particular kind of case, it shouldn't apply. Okay, I'm not going to save time for sir rebuttal, so I think I'll just continue on.
No cross appeal.
Yeah, there's no cross appeal here, so I don't know that you have. Yeah.
This thing beeped at me and it scared me.
Okay. You still have 4 minutes and 5 seconds.
You know, one of the things that really puzzled us in the opening, or rather in the reply brief, was that they said that we had failed to show that this was a contract action, that we were trying to say that this was a contract action, and that the economic loss doctrine only applies in contract actions. It says in a contract action you can't get tort-like damages. Well, we've never made that argument. We've never even mentioned that consideration. In fact, our position is there was no contract. But the law doesn't require, as the plaintiff says, that it has to be either contract or it has to be either tort. Well, there could be contract claims and tort claims arising out of the same incident. It's just that the contract claims have to be based upon promise-based duties or breach of those duties, and the tort claims have to be based on duties that are breached implied in law, such as physical or personal injury or property damage. So when you're talking about the claims in the case which relate to breach of contract, you're talking about the loss of the benefit of the bargain or the
Isn't the economic loss a limitation of damages in tort cases, that if you have contracts, your damages are defined by the terms
right.
of the contract, where tort, they're more open-ended, and the economic loss doctrine cuts off liability there based on certain circumstances. So would you agree with that?
Yes, I would.
Okay.
But you can also have cases which are strictly negligence only, mm-hmm. or cases which have negligence and contract. It just doesn't matter. It applies to any kind of tort claim made in, or negligence claim made in any context. And in fact, there are several Nevada cases where no contracts were involved. And specifically, I just mentioned it briefly, the Culinary Workers versus Stern was one of them, 98 Nevada, 409. The Luckett v. Dumani case, 121 Nevada, 44. And also a case cited in Callaway, the Raymerth v. Hart, case, an Idaho case, 983 Pacific 2nd, 848. Mm-hmm. In those cases, there was either no contract claims alleged, or there were no surviving contract claims.
I think that then they were just economic. Stern, wasn't that out of the MGM fire, and the union sued, saying they lost wages and all, and those claims were purely economic and not physical or property. So the court dismissed that, if I remember what happened in that one.
That's correct. That's correct. Well, I see my time is up, so I'll go sit down.
Thank you so much, Mr. Carl. Ms. Hudgens. 4 minutes and 42 seconds.
I'll try to be shorter than that. I think that the point here today is respondent's admission that Mr. Marion may be able to show the physical manifestations of harm. And those are the types of proof that need to be made later on down the road. At this point, what we're talking about at a motion to dismiss stage is whether or not the plaintiff has pled with sufficient particularity his claim. If he has not done that, dismissal with prejudice is the inappropriate result. The appropriate result under this court's holdings is to allow the plaintiff an opportunity to amend. And so in this case, the fact that the district court dismissed with prejudice, where there was no finding of a lack of due diligence, and where there was no opportunity for Mr. Marion to actually submit any proof later on down the road, the district court abused its discretion.
The dismissal with prejudice, was the statute of limitations up, or why did the court do that, you know, to your knowledge, the dismissal with prejudice?
You know, I actually have no information on that. It wasn't included in the minute order. It was included in the final order that was filed and entered by the court. The difference between the two of those, there's no finding or factual conclusion to state one way or the other why that decision was made.
Questions?
And did you expand your research to look at how other courts that have not adopted particular rules to govern pro se civil filings and prisoner filings in particular handle the assessment of a discretionary dismissal such as the one we had here? In other words, what do other courts do with it? I was interested in some cases where, for example, in a pro se setting, some of the federal circuit courts say if you're going to file a motion for summary judgment, you must tell the pro se opponent that they need to file something by a certain date, and they have to demonstrate genuine issues of fact and what that means. And if you don't, your case is going to be dismissed. So they're having a plain English kind of gloss on it by rule. Without a rule, to what extent should courts factor in the unique circumstances of a prisoner or a pro se, or in this case, both litigant?
Right, I understand the question. And I did look at some of the Ninth Circuit cases where they've extended the Kellogg rule to motion practice as well as the notice of appeal, finding that there's really no difference between the two of those things. And in most of the Ninth Circuit cases that I found, that 10-day period was scrutinized much more closely than even a 30-day deadline. And so, as Your Honor suggested, there is some notice to the pro se litigant that the consequences of failing to oppose in a timely matter could possibly be dismissal of a case. In this instance, it's difficult because we don't know when Mr. Marion actually received the papers. There's no process in the prison that says received, or, you know, we have no way to track that deadline. So we don't know if he received the motion the Monday before he actually submitted his filing, or if it was a time, you know, substantially before that period. What I would suggest, and what I think both you and Justice Seda have asked, is where do we draw the line? And I think in the couple of cases that that have been published in Nevada, there's a line where there are multiple extensions or delay throughout a case. And so in the King case, there's a 24-day delay, but that's a summary judgment motion, and the litigant had been delaying the process throughout the entire case. And also in Walls versus Brewster, there were two extensions to file an opposition. Nothing was ever filed. That's not what we're dealing with here. And so when you have a process like there is in the 8th Judicial District, where they have a hearing set for every motion, and they also have a local rule that says that the court clerk presents motion practice no later than 3 days before the motion is set to be heard, I would submit that that three-day period would be a more appropriate way to analyze the due diligence of a proper person litigant.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hutchins. This matter will stand submitted. Thank you both. Thank you all for your submissions and your arguments here today.